All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to welcome back our guest this week, Jonathan Boyar. Jonathan is the president of Boyar Research and is a principal of Boyar Asset Management. For anyone new joining us this week, or those of you who may have missed it in the past, we did feature Jonathan back in September of last year with another great presentation. We invite you to go back, check that out once we finish up here today. Lots more great information there to gain from Jonathan. So do please go take a peek at it once we finish up here today. As always, for those of you out in the audience, looks like Mike is beating me to the point already. Please say hi, let us know where you are viewing from, and post those questions and comments in the chat section throughout the presentation. Once we get to the end of things, we'll jump into Q&A with Jonathan, as we usually do here on these things. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead, hand things over to Jonathan. We can jump into his presentation today and start cruising through things.
Great. No, thank you for having me back. Thank you, Guru Focus. And I also just want to first start thanking the team at Boyar, the great analysts who, without their work, these presentations really wouldn't be possible. Here's for the lawyers. You can read that at your leisure. So, just first, what is the Boyar Value Group? We've been around for quite a while. The firm was started by my father, Mark, in 1975, really to provide independent research to mutual funds, hedge funds, family offices, taking a very different approach to investing, really a private equity approach to stock market investing. And fortunately, the firm developed a good reputation, and in 1983, he formed Boyar Asset Management, to manage money. He's an SEC registered advisor, and we still have both businesses to this day. So what am I going to do today? First, I'm going to quickly, for about 5 minutes, discuss how we come up with investment ideas. I'm going to review some of the picks from last year's presentation and give some updates, and I'm going to present ideas that come really from three different schools of value investing and discuss the investment case for them. The first company I'm going to present is an example of a great consumer franchise selling at a pretty discounted price. The second example I'm going to give today is a statistically cheap stock. It's more in the traditional kind of Graham camp, I guess. And the third one is a non-traditional value stock, like when we did PayPal maybe 5 or 6 years ago. While it's not statistically cheap, there are things that we see value in. So first, as I said, just a little bit about us. We analyze, we take a private equity approach to stock market investing. We analyze everything from the point of view of a potential acquirer. And we're also extraordinarily patient. We're not looking for companies that are going to make us money in 6 months to a year, although that's obviously nice. We're looking 2, 3, 4 years down the road, which I think, and I'll discuss this later, gives us a competitive advantage. Deep research really is at the heart of what we do. We are a research company, and we analyze each company in distinct ways. We analyze it how an acquirer of that business would value it, and that's we don't take out candidates per se, but because of our methodology, a fair amount of the companies that we both research and eventually buy for our clients end up being acquired. We stick to our knitting. We really only invest in businesses we know, we understand, that we can explain. We're market cap agnostic, we're sector agnostic. We'll invest in microcaps to Microsoft, is what I like to say. However, there are certain types of businesses that we just won't touch. Commodity oriented businesses would be one example. Because we look at everything through the lens of an acquirer, I wouldn't want to own a company that's entirely dependent on the price of a commodity that's outside of our control, in energy's case, namely oil. And that's generally kept us out of trouble. While it's hurt us this year with energy shares, rising pretty high. You have to remember that in 2020, I think energy shares were down on average about 37%. So people ask me, you know, how does the Boyer Value Group come up with ideas? You know, there's no magic formula, there's no screen, there's no algorithm. It's really just being curious, reading, just being in the business. Although, you know, we've systematized our approach a little bit, and we look for companies in different buckets. You know, for example, I have here, written here the business value approach. We love looking at businesses that are in industries that are out of favor and pick the best of the bunch and find companies within those businesses that are long-term winners, or in those industries that are long-term winners. Hidden asset approach is probably our favorite approach. We love looking for companies with valuable assets that are not properly reflected on the balance sheet. And we're, you know, special situation investors as well. But what separates us from a lot of value investors is catalysts. You know, a lot of people say value is its own catalyst. To us, that's not really enough. It's critically important to us, and we think that helps us avoid value traps. You know, as I mentioned earlier, my father, Mark, who started the firm and is still very much involved, you know, has instilled in me and instilled in our team that you can find the greatest company in the world selling at a cheap price, but if the stock doesn't go up in value, it doesn't do you any good. So what's our advantages, our competitive advantage? You know, where we look, you know, we like looking at underfollowed, underowned names. You know, that's where you can really generate, I think, excess returns. And having a long-term mindset is also extremely helpful. There are plenty of investors out there playing the short-term game. Playing the long-term game, I think, is significantly easier. Just most people don't do it. They just don't have the patience. Our research, I really think, is our main competitive advantage. You know, we've been doing this since 1975, producing independent research to some of the most sophisticated investors in the world. And I think getting critical feedback from them, having to continuously come up with new ideas and hearing why they like them or don't like them is critically important to our investment process. So our short-term report card, it's okay. You know, our results have been fine. These are the companies that we presented last year. I pay very little heed to short-term results, but the companies certainly have done fine. I'm not going to waste time because I want to go through the three new ideas. But at the end of the presentation, I'm going to present the link, and I believe Guru Focus is also going to provide a link to you where you'll get some of the names that we presented today, plus our latest reports on Madison Square Garden Entertainment and Madison Square Garden Sports, which we think are extremely interesting companies. So the first company I'm going to present is Scotts Miracle-Gro. It's an example of a great consumer franchise, you know, selling at a significant discount to our estimate of intrinsic value. And it's worth noting because there's a lot of talk on inflation these days. Consumer franchises are fantastic investments in inflationary environments as they have pricing power. And this is a company that we've followed since you know, roughly 2011. And you know, here's a little the financials of the company. And you know, so what really is Scotts Miracle-Gro? Most people are familiar with their traditional consumer business, where they basically have Coca-Cola like market share, and they've been a huge pandemic beneficiary. What's not as well known is they have a division that they started not too long ago called Hawthorne, which is a hydroponics company that, you know, primarily serves the cannabis industry, and it's growing rapidly into a major business, which I'm going to talk about later, which could potentially be a catalyst for the stock. So I really can't stress enough how important Scotts Miracle-Gro's brand recognition is. I'll just give you one example. You know, they have a competitor, Central Garden and Pet. And a few years ago, or maybe more than a few years ago, you know, we were looking through their Central Garden Pet's filings. And one, in the risk section, it says, our companies compete principally against products marketed by the Scotts Miracle-Gro company. Scott's dominant position in the lawn and garden industry is a significant competitive disadvantage for our similar garden products. So there, this is a competitor saying this. They really have a fantastic brand and name recognition. As I mentioned earlier, they're a big pandemic beneficiary as well. You know, millennials love gardening. And one of the bear cases before the pandemic is a lot of millennials weren't going to move to the suburbs, so there's less of a need for Scotts lawn care products. But however, because of the pandemic, many are moving to the suburbs. And it's kind of ironic. I went back and I reviewed our report from 2011, and we were talking about a big growth driver would be baby boomers retiring. In fact, it seems that millennials are even better customers than baby boomers in this regard. As I mentioned also, you know, it has a great consumer franchise, so it helps with it, you know, combat inflation. They were able to put up, you know, I think a 5% price increase in August, and they're going to institute another one, I believe, in January or February of this year. So as discussed before, they're a huge pandemic beneficiary, and with millennials moving to the suburbs, and I think they got around 20 million new customers, and you know the surveys that they have done suggest that the vast majority are going to stay with the company, and intuitively that makes sense. You know, consumers who built gardens in their backyard are probably going to keep working on them, and in addition, the continued legalization of cannabis throughout the United States will greatly help the Hawthorne business. So shares have been significantly under pressure. They peaked in April around $254 or so, and they got down to the high 130s. That's when we really started getting interested again, you know, during that downward slope. And there was a few reasons for the decline. You know, none of them impact our long-term thesis of the company. But it's worth noting over the same period, you know, marijuana-related companies, cannabis-related companies have fared quite poorly. But there are other reasons. They benefited so greatly and had so many new customers during the pandemic that they invest in the future, which is impacting gross margins. And they also were going against really tough comps. We like investing in companies where the operators have skin in the game, and this is certainly the case for Scotts Miracle-Gro. The family owns about 26% of the company. They're really good capital allocators, you know, and they have great cash flow, which has allowed them to delever, you know, fairly significantly. And they're also very smart with their money. They pay special dividends when the stock is expensive. On earnings calls, you know, relatively recently when the stock price was in the high 250 or so, they discussed how they were thinking of special dividends. Now they've been hinting that they'll be buying back a significant amount of stock. So what's going to make the stock ascend in value? You know, what's going to make it go up? You know, continued buybacks, banking, cannabis, banking reform, and continued legalization, I think certainly will help, as will a potential spin out of Hawthorne, I don't think the company is valued correctly today. And in the last earnings call, you know, they addressed the possibility of spinning out Hawthorne, and this is something that I think could happen in the next few years. So here's valuation. This is how we get to it. As I said earlier, you'll have access to our report by just going to a site that Guru Focus will provide to you. But this is how we get to it. And, you know, the way we look at it at today's share price, you're essentially buying a great consumer franchise at a private market value, you know, the U.S. consumer business, and getting the rapidly growing cannabis business for about 1x revenue, which is significantly below what it's really worth. The next company I'm going to present is Curate Retail. And this falls in the bucket of a traditional value investment, you know, just statistically cheap stock. I think it's selling about 3x earnings. It's controlled by media mogul John Malone. And it sells at a low PE because of the misguided view, at least in our opinion, of the sustainability of the business. So what is Curate? You know, it has a strange name, so many people might not know it. It owns QVC, it owns Home Shopping Network, it owns Zulily, which was an ill-fated acquisition many years ago, and the Cornerstone Group, which has brands like Frontgate. It's a great business that fantastic operating margins, you know, compared to other retailers, you know, high and stable EBITDA margins, and you know, ridiculously strong levels of free cash flow. You know, we think we calculate the free cash flow yield of about 26%. So they've returned a lot of capital back to shareholders. In fact, they just issued, I believe, either $1.25 or $1.50. Special dividend. Curate's a really good business. There's a misconception about the customer base, about you know, what they sell, based on probably what they sold in the 1980s, where they were selling shower radios, etc. You know, it consists of an attractive demographic. You know, people spend a lot of money on the site, the average customer. And the fanatics really purchase a lot of money, and they have great retention. So it's really misunderstood, and the numbers bear this out. You know, year in, year out, they generate a significant level of cash flow. After a terrible 2019, it had a great 2020. And, you know, they've done a great job of getting on streaming platforms, put them in position to be a pandemic beneficiary. And the question really remains, and why the shares are depressed, is, you know, will they be able to continue their momentum post-pandemic? We think they will. Unfortunately, the latest results don't bear that out, but a lot had to do with supply chain issues, which we do believe is true. And I think at these levels, the stock is, you know, too cheap to ignore. You know, it's selling at 3x earnings. As I mentioned earlier, they recently issued a special dividend. They're buying back a ton of stock. They issued, I think, 2 special dividends last year. And they also issued a preferred stock to investors as well. So they've been extremely shareholder friendly. And, you know, because of the financial profile of the business, you know, we wouldn't be surprised if the company either goes private or is acquired by a competitor. And, you know, here's our valuation, how we get to it. And, you know, so here it is. So here's the last company. Most value investors probably are not thinking about Uber, but in a lot of ways, because it's not a traditionally cheap stock. But like PayPal, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, when we looked at it, you know, we see a lot of value in the network it has. They have two real main businesses, the mobility, which is, you know, the rides business, and delivery, which you all are I'm sure familiar, and delivery obviously has been a big pandemic beneficiary. And mobility is currently depressed, and I think this is why it's a great reopening play, you know, due to the pandemic. But I think as people get back to a normal life, you know, Uber's mobility business should thrive. And the perception of Uber on Wall Street, I think, is wrong. People are remembering its unicorn days, where it was spending crazy amounts of money to gain market share. You know, that was done under an old regime that's no longer there. They have a great new manager running the business. They've streamlined the portfolio. They collectively generate $100 billion in run rate gross bookings. And they've been smart. You know, they're doing smart growth in the businesses or the regions where they can't have a legitimate path to be number one or number two. They've sold the business to their competitors, but they've kept equity stakes. So they've been able to participate in upside in a lot of different regions. And it's worth noting the company just reported its, you know, first positive quarterly adjusted EBITDA performance. And, you know, management is voting with their feet. The CEO bought, $5 or $10 million of stock on the open market recently. So there's significant operating leverage in the business. You know, pre-pandemic, the mobility was tracking at, you know, 30% adjusted EBITDA margins, which was up significantly from a few years earlier as they stopped giving drivers incentives and were really running it as a business. Obviously, the pandemic has interrupted that story. But as I mentioned, as more people get back to traveling, going to work, going out, the mobility business should do quite well. They've also done a great job on the expense side. They've reduced corporate overheads. And, you know, we estimate they could have about $3.5 billion in EBITDA by 2023. You know, and there's a lot of cross-selling. There's a cross-selling story as well between Uber Eats or the mobility and the delivery business. And we think that's something that's really underappreciated in the Uber story. Like everyone else or every other company or most companies, Uber has been plagued by labor shortages, but they spent aggressively and invested aggressively to get riders back. And they've done a good job of it, as you see from here, from the statistics. The number of drivers is up 65% since January, and the wait times have gone down. So they're doing a really good job. And also, this is a company that the newspapers love to pick on, and the regulators do too. That's the curse of being number one. But we kind of view things a little bit differently. You know, the regulatory issues will be there, but they're best equipped to handle it because of their size. So if you look at the multiples of what it trades for compared to companies like Lyft, and other than, you know, delivery businesses, it really doesn't make sense. You know, here's our valuation. And again, so we have about 72% upside from current levels. And, you know, that, you know, you can get further details on our work just by going to that website. So that's the three ideas. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. And again, I want to thank Guru Focus for having me speak on this talk.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Jonathan. We do have a couple of questions lined up here. Definitely some interesting ideas brought up there. First question rolling in from the Jewish man. And obviously we've had a couple of these numbers, you know, on these slides here. But he's asking, how do you like to value a company? How do you go about finding value? Obviously, there's some EBITDA, revenue, things like that on there. Can you walk us through the process, I guess, if you were starting from scratch approaching a company, how you'd go about valuing it?
I think you have to be really flexible, and you have to look, you know, what would an acquirer pay for that business? And so, you know, people buy hotels based on, you know, multiple of RevPAR. So you look at that. So you just have to look at comparable transactions. You have to look at the business quality. So it's not a one size fits all solutions on valuing the business. You know, it's definitely a science, but there is some art to doing it. I mean, this, you know, so that's how you do it. I wish I had a more clever or succinct answer, but the answer is it depends.
Definitely. And I think that flexibility is a good approach nowadays with everything getting a little bit crazy, kind of changing about. Has that, I guess, changed your thought process on valuation with some of the more recent swings, changes, Fed buying a lot? Interest rates, things like that. Has your strategy changed all over the last year or so since we talked to you last?
The strategy hasn't changed. I mean, you know, people talk about TINA, there is no alternative, you know, and that will propel equities higher. We just look at things and, you know, we're not afraid to hold cash if we can't find attractive opportunities. We just look at every business in a very simple way. You know, would an acquirer buy this business for this, if they could, the entire business for this price? And if it's selling significantly below that, we'll buy it. So we, you know, obviously we pay attention to macro things. You know, we try to distance ourselves as much as possible. You know, for example, if you were to look at the state of the world in March 2020, no one would have bought anything, but it ended up being one of the greatest buying opportunities I've ever seen. You just had to have been patient. So your best, at least in my opinion, or our firm's opinion, going on a company by company basis and not, you know, ignoring the macro noise.
Understood. And nice little segue there into a question from a couple of viewers here. First put out by Assad and then echoed by Todd a little further down, pointing out that Buffett's got around 150-ish billion in cash at this point in time and doesn't really seem to be making any significant purchases. Their question specifically is asking, do you think it's safer to accept kind of this inflationary erosion of cash rather than potentially buying into something overvalued and getting burnt down the road?
Yeah, no, the Berkshire, you know, what he's done during the pandemic has surprised me. Listen, I'm never going to criticize Warren Buffett, especially on a public forum. I mean, he's the greatest investor of all time, bar none. But, you know, he has different criteria. He wants to keep that fortress-like balance sheet. But he himself has said that, you know, cash is a terrible investment. But, you know, he does have to keep cash on his balance sheet, not nearly as much as he does currently, you know, for regulatory reasons. But he is buying back his own stock. He does have, you know, big equity stakes in companies as well. But the amount, you know, his inactivity, at least in my opinion, has been surprising. But, you know, you don't want to count Warren Buffett out.
Definitely. And continuing on, a question from one of our regular viewers, and I'm going with Dale from here on out. So hopefully that's close enough for you there as far as the name goes. This is a debate we've had here, Jonathan, for the last couple of weeks now, with them coming in and out and asking questions, and I haven't been corrected yet, so we're gonna go with Dale. But they're asking, what does your sell strategy look like? When do you choose to sell? Why do you do it?
Selling is much harder than buying. I mean, most of our accounts are taxable. First, I guess the first thing is, you know, a lot of the companies that we invest in end up getting acquired, as I mentioned during the report. So the sell decision is made for us in certain instances. But, you know, we're extraordinarily tax sensitive. And, you know, we really only sell if it gets, you know, blatantly overvalued, or we can find some really great opportunities elsewhere with that cash, you know, because of, you know, every time you sell a stock, depending on how long you've owned it, you know, you get to pay Uncle Sam, you know, 30% or so, 25-30% after everything is all said and done. So that's a really big hurdle. So, you know, we sell also when, you know, we think our investment thesis has changed. It's, you know, as well, if we're wrong, we leave a position. But, you know, we're in things for the long term. I think if, you know, you look, our average holding period, you know, our turnover is about 10%. So we're definitely more patient than most.
Definitely. And I guess to kind of put you on the spot here, if I were to ask you to say, you know, how many stocks, or rough guess percentage wise of the number of times that you guys do get it wrong, is it relatively low, I would assume, with you guys holding things for a relatively long period?
Yeah, I don't know if I can put a number on it, but like everyone else, we make our mistakes, you know, we fall into value traps. But what we really try and avoid, and we've been pretty successful, obviously not entirely successful, is, you know, real major mistakes, real blow-ups. That's what you want to avoid, you know, that destruction, permanent destruction of capital. And if you look at businesses through the lens that we're looking in and have that big margin of safety in terms of evaluation, you know, you generally don't run into big problems.
Understood. So playing things smart and doing your homework seems like it tends to pay off here.
It does. And a lot of times doing nothing, you know, it's an action, you know, just holding on to great businesses and letting them compound. You know, two of our biggest holdings at the firm are, you know, Microsoft and Home Depot, which we've owned, and while we've sold some of it, you know, we just, you know, we couldn't find better things to replace it with. And, you know, for clients who were with us in 2007, 2008, when no one wanted to own these things, they've been richly rewarded, and, you know, they've been able to compound tax-free.
Definitely. So it sounds like patience is definitely paying off on those guys, and keeping your toes in the water rather than pulling out when things might seem like they're getting too hot.
Yeah. No, I would definitely agree with that.
All righty. Well, continuing down our list, looks like Yadnesh, and hopefully I'm saying this one right, is harking us back to that last presentation you made with us, and they would like to know your opinion, or your thoughts, I guess I should say, on MSGN being taken over by MSGE, and what do you think about these guys now? Obviously, you said you still got them. They seem to be doing pretty good. Some overarching thoughts there from you?
Yeah, you know, we were, and it's a very good question, we were disappointed with the deal. It muddled the story, in our opinion. We own shares in both MSGE, MSGN. So it ended up being a wash, but MSGE bought MSGN. MSGN was the networks, the RSN business, at a ridiculously low valuation. But since I was getting paid in MSGE stock, it doesn't really matter. But to us, it muddied the story. Before MSGE, which owns Madison Square Garden, the actual building, it owns the, you know, Radio City Music Hall, you know, all the Sphere, lots of other things, was a pure reopening story. Now it's a reopening story coupled with a regional sports network and the problems that they have, and investors have punished the name. But we really like MSGE. It's, to me, a really cheap stock. As I said, you know, you'll be able to get our report if you like. But, you know, one of the things that I think is going to propel it is online sports gambling, which was recently legalized in New York. And that should greatly benefit both the network part of the business as well as the garden and also the sports teams as well.
Understood. Well, sounds like you got a little bit diluted there for a minute, but looks like there's some positive things happening there in the future.
Yeah, no. As I said, we didn't like the deal. But as a shareholder in both, and it didn't necessarily matter. But it also, one of the things that it did was it reinforced the street's view of their view on James Dolan, who I think is still a very good operator. But you know, it took away some trust and you know made the skepticism even higher. But overall, he's done a great job by shareholders over the long term.
Understood. Continuing on down our list, looks like Dane's asking if we can swing back to Uber for a minute, asking if you could elaborate on kind of the moat of Uber that you were starting to bring up there in relation to Lyft and some of the other competitors in the space.
I think it's just their pure size. I mean, having that net, that large of a network is something that they spent billions of dollars to do. And it was kind of irrational capital, but as you know, when you're buying it and at this price, it doesn't really matter that was done in the past. And no company is going to go out and try and replicate this. So it's you know that's really the point of the scale there. You know, it's like kind of a virtuous feedback loop. You know, you're only going to go on a network that has a lot of drivers, and a lot of drivers are only going to go on a network that has a lot of passengers. And you know, Uber is the biggest one, you know, in the U.S. for the rides business, much bigger than Lyft. So it has a big advantage.
Gotcha. And just to throw something out for curiosity, whether it comes to fruition or not, these kind of reported EV changes, potential deals, you know, throwing out Tesla, Hertz, names like that, changing things. Do you think that'll be an additional draw for drivers, customers, potentially, if they can kind of orchestrate this shift over to EVs?
I don't think the EVs, and I think the EVs are going to take longer than people think. I don't think that's going to be the big thing for Uber. I guess the real bear case would be, you know, AI, you know, automated driving, etc. But that kind of stuff, I think, is so far in the future that and is so uncertain when and how it will occur that it's really not shouldn't be in front and center. You know, currently for the foreseeable future, they have a fantastic business with a really good moat.
Gotcha. So, but potential for maybe we'll call it decades down the road for maybe some of our sci-fi fantasies to come true there, but nothing we have to worry about right now.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, going back to in 2005, you told me I could take out my phone and order a car and it'll be in my driveway in 3 minutes. I would have thought you were crazy. So I'll put that caveat there.
Definitely. Definitely some changes out there and some things that we can potentially look forward to in the future there. Yes. So continue it on now. Looks like Eric chiming in here asking, do you like to read? How do you learn, get better as an investor? What's the, I guess, career growth kind of look like for you? Where are you turning to for inspiration and knowledge?
Yeah, no, I've been fortunate in growing up in this business. The first part of the question about reading, if you don't like to read, this is, at least if you're going to do fundamental analysis, this is really the wrong business for you. You essentially, your job is to read and your job is to be curious. You know, I read multiple papers a day. I read basically anything I can get my hands on, you know, various other research reports, industry trade publications, our team of analysts, you know, we have a terrific team. You know, we write notes all the time to each other. So you have to want to constantly learn, constantly hone your craft, and to admit that you also have to know that you're not going to know everything about a business. You try to get as much as you can, but you're never going to have all the facts in a row. But yeah, reading is a huge part of it.
For sure. Follow-up question from Eric here, switching gears on you a bit, though, and tossing out one of our hot topics here over the last couple months, asking, what do you think about Chinese stocks, specifically putting out ADRs? Are you guys going in strong, keeping a cautious eye on it? Where do you guys stand there?
You know, we really just kind of stay away. We stick to our knitting. We know U.S. investing. I'm not saying Chinese stocks are not a good idea. I just don't know. The regulatory framework does scare me, but it seems like in some of these you're getting compensated for that in valuation. But I believe it was Jason Zweig a couple months ago, maybe even more, wrote a really good piece about, you know, investors in Chinese equities really have not been rewarded very well over the, despite the enormous growth that country has exhibited over the past couple of decades. So I'm finding enough names in the U.S. where, you know, I understand the culture, I understand the regulatory framework. So I just avoid it, not to say that it couldn't be a good investment.
Gotcha. So playing things safe, sticking to your guns.
Exactly.
All right. And continuing on, looks like Todd's tossing out a big idea question for you here. What do you think of the current market? Is it overvalued? And further down, we have some others chiming in. You know, are we in a bubble? Is this, are EVs, you know, going to tech bubble of late 90s, early 2000s? Where are we sitting? What do you think is going to happen?
I'm an individual stock guy, so I just look at things on a stock-by-stock basis. You know, the market, we don't estimate, you know, what the S&P is going to earn for the next year, et cetera. But, you know, there are signals of frothiness that do worry us. You know, crypto, a lot of speculative assets, some of these SPACs, some of these EV companies, I think it's with Rivian coming out recently. So there are things that do give us pause, but, you know, it's the leaders like the Apple, et cetera, as I'm not recommending that as an investment, but they don't seem crazily overvalued. And that's what really, or Google or Facebook or Amazon, well, they are overvalued for a value investor. They're not at extreme levels, and that's what's really going to drive the market because of the weightings. If you go back to 1999 and you see what Cisco was trading at on a PE basis, you know, that was in the stratosphere. We don't have that yet. But the speculative manias, or at least in our opinion, speculative manias outside of the, the major stocks do worry us.
Definitely. So things are getting up there, not quite as crazy as they've ever been. I guess the follow-up question I'd put out there is, obviously, stick to your guns and, you know, you go in, you do the research, and you find the companies that are working for you guys. Is it tempting, I guess, to play around with some of these kind of newer names out there that are going up on these crazy valuations?
It's tempting, but I think one of the things that I've been able to teach myself is, and I give my father credit for doing this for me, is to stick to what you're doing. You know, it's frustrating when you go to parties, or when we used to go to parties, or whatever, you hear people, you know, doubling, tripling their money in crypto, Tesla, and all these other things that I think are just ridiculously overvalued. But I think these people are taking major risks, and, you know, I'm very disciplined in what I do. You know, I'm happy. I just look at what my returns are. I don't look really what other people are doing. And I'm just happy with my own investments. Sure, I would, you know, in the benefit of hindsight, 2 years ago, I would have loaded up on Tesla. But to me, that was just a gamble. It's not investing.
Definitely. And understood, hearing you loud and clear here. I think definitely there's some sense in not trying to go too crazy out there. Well, question coming in from Praveen here, one of our regular viewers and contributors here at Guru Focus, asking, what is your view of AMCX, another Dolan family-controlled entity like MSG?
No, it's a really cheap name. One of the things that's interesting, I'm not as close to the name, but one of the things that's really interesting is a lot of the executives have left recently. I don't know if that portends for a sale in the future, but it's a subscale network that has great IP. That would be a great acquisition for a number of companies. So I guess stay tuned. But I do think it's a cheap name. It's just I think just a question of when it gets sold. But who knows? You don't want that to be your investment thesis.
Gotcha. And looks like Dale's chiming in here with another question. Interesting one here, and upfront I'll say answer to your level of comfort here on this one. But the overarching question here is, what guides kind of your investment philosophy? Does religion or a specific philosophy, something like that, or I guess historically successful investors like Buffett or Graham, what kind of is guiding that overall philosophy for you?
I mean, I think you have to be a student of history, see what's worked well for other people, and just you got to find what's comfortable for you, what lets you sleep at night. One of the things that I think is incredibly important that you really can't teach is patience. Just not hoping or wanting for instant gratification. Obviously, it's nice when it occurs, but do the homework, have the courage of your convictions, and stick with it. And stick with that framework, and not chase the latest fad or gimmick.
Definitely. And almost perfect transition there for us into our next question from Todd coming in here, asking your thoughts on meme stocks, AMC valuation, things like that, with retail traders kind of coming in and throwing things into a frenzy per se.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the speculative excess that I'm worried about. Although I guess you could argue for Hertz and a couple other things, they were right. So, I guess that's the wisdom of crowds. But I just, the valuations they're putting on some of these things are insane. I think it's just, to me, it doesn't make sense. It drives the market in the short term. In the long term, I don't think it makes a huge difference.
Definitely. And with the, I guess, kind of, we'll call it widespread interest or emergence of interest in people who might not have been involved in the sphere, do you think this trend might continue in the future with a lot more kind of eyes being on the world of investing?
It'll continue until people start losing a lot of money. And then it will not continue. I think, the market is, except for a brief moment in March and April, have gone in one direction. And these people have seen who are investing in meme stocks, whatever, crypto, have seen spectacular gains. And, why wouldn't you want to continue to put money into these markets if you're having these, spectacular gains? But at some point in time, people are going to lose a lot of money. And unfortunately, if history repeats itself, it's the retail investor who's left holding the bag.
Gotcha. So the inevitable hammer may fall, and hazard I say, and I'm going out on a big limb here, bubble may pop for some of these people in the future, and they'll probably be quick to pull their money out once they get burned.
Yeah, once they get burned, I mean, you have the gamification of things. You have, Robinhood makes it really easy because of the no-cost trading. It's really not no cost when you look at a lot of other factors. And to me, what I also don't understand is it's not like trading commissions before them were ridiculously expensive. So I think it's going to end badly. I don't know when. It could go on for a lot longer than anyone would expect.
All righty. Well, I guess we will just have to keep our eyes open and watch and see what things happen in the future.
Absolutely.
Question here from Mitchell with multiple M's, asking your thoughts on using systematic value screens for idea generation. And for example, here he's tossing out Greenblatt's magic formula.
Yeah, I listen. How can you argue with Joel Greenblatt? He's one of the most successful investors out there. I think it's certainly one tool, but if everyone has access to the same information, then it's really, you're not going to have any sort of edge. But I think it could be a good starting point for things. But I think a lot of the name, there are a lot of names that you'd also miss that don't screen well. When you're screening for cheap stocks, you don't see that Madison Square Garden, owns the air rights that are extremely valuable above MSG. Things like that just don't pop up. Or the network effects of Uber, or when, the list goes on and on. It's certainly a very useful tool.
Gotcha. So good starting point, but could be some additional opportunities out there that you might miss if you're not really diving in deeper.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, continuing on, we have another question rolling in from Assad here. A little bit of a long one, so bear with me here while I work through their run-up. But some people claim that things are different now with seemingly quantitative easing becoming a new norm. Argument that old economic analysis has kind of expired at this point in time. Do you think that things are different now and the rules of the game have changed?
Listen, when I was in school and you told me things were zero interest rate environment for years, or you're negative in Europe, I mean, that certainly impacted things. But the basic fundamentals, of what makes a good company, a good business, haven't changed. Obviously, technology has been a big part of that, of what constitutes a good business. But the law of supply and demand still exists. All sorts of, basic, we have a rules of law, everything that, constitutes a market are still there. It's, interest rates are just one part of the variable, a very important part. And, if rates stay low, it takes away a lot of other opportunities. But I don't think things have permanently been altered. But the Fed and other central bankers, are going to be, walking a very delicate line, trying to get back to a normal interest rate environment.
Gotcha. So some changes have been had, but business still has to be making money to be making money.
Yes. At the end of the day, you're buying companies. And interest rates will affect the multiple that you pay for companies, et cetera. But, at the end of the day, that's what you have to really focus on.
For sure. And question from Abel coming in here, asking, do you invest in the biotech, pharma, medtech spheres? If so, do you have a different valuation approach for them, or do you kind of follow the same rules here?
Biotech, we definitely stay away from, because they have binary outcomes. It's either you make a ton of money or you lose money, and you need special expertise, which we don't have. We do invest in companies that are a little easier to understand, like a Merck and a Pfizer that are selling at very low multiples of earnings, have great franchises, et cetera, and the problems that Wall Street is, putting as narrative, we don't think are true. But anything that's reliant on a real technology that could change really quickly, we just, kind of put in the too hard pile.
For sure. Understood there. Question from Mark here, and I'm going to go ahead and lump in an additional one from Praveen, since it's sort of on the same note here. But asking up front, do you sell call options on any of the stocks you own? And then Praveen chiming in with, do you do any short side investing there as well?
Yeah, I certainly don't short. I think shorting is a way that a lot of investment managers use to justify higher fees. And very few people are good at it. I don't like the risk reward of shorting. You know, covered calls is certainly a legitimate way of doing things. We don't do that, but you know, at least at this time. But you know, it certainly makes sense if you have a concentrated position in something.
Gotcha. And an additional question here from Praveen. Interesting one here that I'll toss at you. Asking, what is the one and one all in caps here investment that you are most excited about right now?
That's a dangerous question. And, you know, there's a whole, that's why you have a portfolio of companies. You know, I'm a risk averse person. You know, when I do a portfolio, and depending on the client, I'll, you know, 15 to 40 stocks or so. So you can't say that, at least for me, something can always go wrong, but there's a whole host of names that I presented, I think are interesting. I think Madison Square Garden Sports, Madison Square Garden Entertainment are interesting, as is Liberty Braves. There's a whole host of stocks that are outside of the mainstream that are unbelievably or pretty cheap, that have good businesses that could grow. So I'm sorry to duck the question, but saying having one stock, it's just not my style.
Gotcha. And sorry to Praveen, doesn't sound like Jonathan is going to pick his favorite child out of the family here on this one.
Exactly.
All righty. Well, it looks like, Jonathan, that is going to currently round out the questions that we have here from the chat. We'll give them another minute or two here to see if they want to toss out any more last minute ones. We are getting just about to our hour mark, so we're getting to the end of the road regardless there. But if any further ones come in there at the end, I will let you know. Outside of that, for anybody out there in the audience, if you missed anything today, you missed any part, you want to flip back to those slides, anything like that, there will be a full recap available here on YouTube as well as on Guru Focus once we finish up here. So do please feel free to take a peek back at it. As always, make sure to like the video, comment any additional questions that we might have missed or that come to you after the fact, and subscribe to the channel if you're new here and want to come back for future content. As Jonathan mentioned, there is that link that he has put together for us for all of you joining here today. We will have that in the description of this video once we finish up. It'll also live on the event archive page on Guru Focus. And once we have our recap article of this presentation finished up here, we'll include it there as well. So a bunch of different options for you guys to go ahead and take a peek at that. Looks like we did have one more question coming in here from Good Investing Talks. This is a tough one here. Not sure that I'm fully understanding it, but I'll toss it out to you to see if it makes sense to you. Do you style like IAC very much? If so, why? And if that makes sense to you, feel free to jump in. We can hang out here for another second if he wants to clarify as well.
I think the question probably was, do I still like IAC, which is Barry Diller's company? And the answer is yes. I think it's very interesting. They just did a great, or in the process of doing a great acquisition of buying Meredith's publishing assets. I also like Angie, which is 85% owned by IAC. I'm 95% sure that was what the person is asking, but if not, they can get in contact with me. I'm happy to try and answer it.
Definitely. And it looks like you were correct on that assumption there. Got the question answered there. No worries there, Good Investing Talks. We made it happen there and got that question answered for you. At this point in time, though, that is going to round things out. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for taking the time to join us, answer these questions, give us another great presentation. It's always a pleasure to have you on here with us.
No, thanks for having me. It's really an honor and a pleasure. And thanks so much.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, everybody, that link will be in the description. Do please go take a peek at it once we finish up here. Without anything further from us here at Guru Focus, we're going to wish everyone the best and strong returns on their investments in the future.